Today I want to talk about a spiritual approach to dealing with stress. Hans Selye, a Canadian medical doctor who made stress a fairly common concept, defines stress as the non-specific response to a demand placed upon the body. When I dissect that statement, I come up with five different concepts: non-specific response, demand put upon, and the body. And what I want to do today is to eliminate a few of these ideas and then concentrate on a couple of the others. The first thing I want to deal with is the idea of the body. Now, clearly, if we didn't have bodies, I wouldn't be talking to you and you wouldn't be listening to me. And while it's very important, if we can change something in the body, that may have an impact on our stress level. But by and large, that's not the main area. First of all, because if we're going to deal with the body in order to change a condition, the condition already exists. Now, this makes sense if you're a pharmaceutical industry person or a medical industry person, that the treatment of the condition, the treatment of the result, the treatment of the physical experience of stress is really what you do for a living. It's where you make your money. It's where all the profits are in the Western medical model. I'm suggesting that waiting till something is a physical reality, a physical manifestation, a physical symptom, is not the best time to be making changes. And so the approach to stress is earlier than that, if you want to be more effective and more efficient. Now, it wouldn't be surprising to us to realize that the United States of America has the most expensive medical system in the world, but compared to other industrialized countries, our health care is not as good as theirs. So it's not a function of how much money we spend on it, it's a function of how we deal with the certain things that lead up to the existence of the conditions. Lots of people make a lot of money in treatment and hunting for patentable medicines or discoveries that can make them and companies billions of dollars. But it seems that not that many people are concerned or interested in a statement that's at least 200 years old in the United States, that is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It is to the person that is going to avoid a condition, but it is not to the person who is selling the pound of cure. There's a lot of money in that pound of cure. If you were to say, I'm going to build a house, you would say, well, you know, before I build a house, this is the time to change the plans so the house is built the way I want. Well, the structure of our bodies can be changed before the condition exists, and that's what I'm suggesting is possible with a spiritual approach to stress, as compared to, let's wait until the house is built, let's wait until the physical condition exists, and that's when we're going to step in and make changes to it. Because the changes require removal of pieces and parts and pretty significant invasive behaviors, both if we're talking about a house and certainly if I'm talking about the human body as the structure we're dealing with. It makes more sense to change it before it occurs rather than after it occurs. With that thought in mind, what I'm going to do is now take body as one of the five concepts, move it off to the side and say, that's not really what we're going to be dealing with today. No question about it, we can improve our bodies by the food we eat and the water we drink and the rest we get and so on. But by and large, there are other places where stress can be impacted more, and let's go to those. So I have four other concepts: the non-specific, I got the response, demand, and put upon. Let me talk about put upon. Put upon is this idea that somebody else puts stress on us, and now we have to respond. They give us the responsibility, and we have to respond to it. But I think, in fairness, once we get past a certain age, we recognize that this cliche may have too much truth to it. I am my own worst enemy. That's a fairly common statement, and I bet most of us have said that more than one time in our lives. So if we're our own worst enemy, that would indicate to us that we're interpreting environmental signals that result in stress. Result in stress because they put a demand on us, and we are not in a position to respond effectively to it. So we're stuck with whatever stuff we put on us. Other people put those things on us as well as a way to control or to manipulate or out of duty or responsibility or, you know, children need structure, I heard just today. And no question about it, children need structure, but they need much less control than and rules, rigid rules than we currently give them. So I agree, kids need structure, but it can be supportive and loving much more than controlling and indicate to them their basic incapabilities as human beings. So I want to take this idea put upon, recognizing there's an opportunity to improve our dealing with stress if we were to deal with that, but not as much as the other concepts that I'm about to deal with. I like the idea of demand. Now, if the average person is going to think of a demand, I demand this, and he demanded that, and she demanded that, as being forceful, deliberate communications of required behavior. But Hanselia didn't mean it in that limited sense. The word demand, from a physiological standpoint, is a response of the body to try to meet this incoming environmental signal, trying to respond to it. So there are other words that could be used in lieu of the word demand. And so if we expand demand to include requirement, need, goal, want, you can start to see, okay, urge, instinct. You could see that we're going to move energy in that direction, just naturally going to grow in that different direction. And I think that's an important idea for us. So demand, which sounds very clear, very forceful, and non-ambiguous, is not the full definition of the word in this scenario. So I think we need to expand it to include these other things. If you've got rules or standards that say things must be done in a certain way, for instance, you look at an unmade bed, and that's contrary to your frame of reference, your frame of reference will put a demand on you to say, this picture does not fit. Make the bed. Now, you just say, oh, it's a habit, it's a this, it's that. But in fact, it's a demand. So they can be very subtle, they can be very loud and direct and very noticeable. But as we're aware of this, it's, we will obey our beliefs, we will obey our pictures of normalcy, what we accept as right, we will start to follow those things. And so the neurotransmitters, the pictures, the mental imagery, the hormones, and all the muscle firing and nerve firing and the movement, all of that stuff is designed to keep us in balance with whatever it is going on for us. We're trying to align and be in harmony with these internal demands that are occurring all the time, every day, every minute, in all kinds of environments. We typically don't recognize the complexity of some of these activities. And even a simple one like this thought, I want to stand up. That just sounds like an ordinary, no big deal kind of thought, but in fact is a demand. But because we may be healthy or in an age group that can do this and does it all the time, there's no big deal. We have this demand, I want to stand up, and then we have a specific response to it. We stand up, no big deal. However, it becomes more complicated if we're too young to stand up and we have the demand to stand up, either by watching people walking around standing and we have yet to develop that skill, we will try and try and try until we develop it. Or if we're old and ill and standing up is a very, very difficult task, then there's our ability to respond specifically to that in an effective way is limited, which sets in motion stress. It could be further complicated when we say, I want to stand up, but when somebody comes along and commands us to stand up, like an office environment or a military environment, for instance, and somebody, we want to stay seated or want to stay prone, and somebody comes in and says, you know, stand up, you're either required by culture or by etiquette to stand up. You're like, didn't want to do that. We don't really have control over that because of these external influences, etiquette and culture and chain of command and that. So we have to do it. We may resist it. We may resent it. And so some of us doesn't want to do it, but our body goes through. We have this internal conflict going, I'm going to do it, but I don't want to do it. I'm going to do it. I don't want to do it. And that is part of the stress. Doing something that we don't want to do is not the act of choosing a specific response. It's going through the motions, but in fact, the response we would have preferred is to stay seated or stay prone. Those kind of things sound real, real simple, but they go on all the time when we have to do things, that is, a demand is delivered to us by our bosses or by a customer or by some other accepted system, either etiquette or profit and loss or fear or so on. I think it's in these two areas of demands and responses that we can make the greatest impact on stress. And in fact, this is really where the spiritual approach to dealing with stress is most important. If we have unreasonable demands placed on us early in life, and who doesn't? Parents put demands on us and before we're able to respond effectively. I've heard of people being forced to be toilet trained well before their time, end up with irritable bowel syndrome and other kind of physical conditions just because of the stress of that early demand beyond the capability of the child, so that there's a demand, but the child can't respond effectively because they don't know how to control the various muscles in their body and so on. All kinds of difficulty can arise from that proof of their inability to do things correctly. Most parents have no idea of the downside of that until the child is older, and recognizing this particular problem has really been difficult. There's also conflict with parents when a parent demonstrates a very common behavior, which is do as I say, not what I do, when they lecture about the dangers of smoking with a cigarette in hand or talk about not doing drugs, alcohol, with a drink in one hand, or they are hungover or they are about to go to a party and that's going to occur. A child that hears that demand of do it one way and the role model is doing it another way is confusing, and it makes the ability of that child to respond to a demand messed up, ambiguous, conflicted, resistant, hard to be effective when you get all these mixed messages. In this culture, Judeo-Christian culture of the Western world, one of the big challenges is the set of demands that are placed on us by our religions. And so when they put this out there as what reality is, what truth is, and we're affected by this, so you can look at the Bible and Judaic tradition, which is, of course, what the Bible is based upon, this belief in a punitive God, the God that's going to punish people who are not good. going to reward the good and punish the bad. That's been around for before there were ever any Christians, and Christianity carried that same idea along with it, probably as a marketing idea in order to win the Jews over to, into the flock of Christians, followers, and we get sold on that 2,000 years after Christ, being told that this is what God is like. I happen to have the good fortune of being the recipient of Christ's letters, a series of 9 letters purportedly Christ being channeled by a woman in South Africa. I got these a few weeks ago. I'm in the middle of letter number 5 out of 9, and to me, these letters are so fantastic, so reassuring, so sense-making out of stuff that's been a very big problem for my human understanding since I was a little kid. And so to be able to read these letters and study these letters, the content, whether, you know, somebody can, well, how do you know it's Christ? Well, what I do know is the content is extremely, extremely valuable. There are lots of very important points in here, that very reassuring, life-affirming points of view that are very practical for us. And the one I want to talk about right now is the idea in there that Christ is saying that this Jewish tradition of a punitive God that has been carried over into Christianity is completely false. Completely false. There is no judgmental, punishing, vengeful, wrathful God. Doesn't exist. God is only loving. Only loving. Only good and love comes from this God. And just that thought is, whoa, wow, so much of what we believe in is because we're afraid of punishment. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. As a kid, terrorized by this image of God sending us to hell was a really very, very big deal. And people are trying to stay out of hell by walking this tightrope of existence, trying not to sin, not to fall, not to fail. And Christ in these letters says, doesn't exist. That doesn't exist. Human beings, through their own thoughts and feelings, punish themselves. God doesn't do it. God is only capable of love. I just find that to be amazing. This really requires a whole lot of thinking, even if you think you're open-minded, like I'll imagine myself to be. This underlying thing of there is no axe hanging over our heads waiting to strike us dead, or lightning going to strike us because we do something bad. The downside of doing something bad is it feels bad. And if we understand that, then we can avoid doing something bad because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good. It's not high vibration. And if we go to higher vibrations, as we choose a higher vibration, we're going to be rewarded right then and there with higher vibration, because it feels better to be kind than it does to be unkind. Some of the things that I've had trouble with in the Bible, and my troubles with religion started at 6 years old when I was told by a layperson in catechism when I was in the first grade that my best friends were going to go to hell because they weren't Catholic. And when I came home crying from that class, my mother asked me what was going on, and I told her, and she said it was total nonsense. It wasn't true. It was not true at all. I could just forget that as an idea, throw that away. And she put on a coat and marched down to church to raise hell with the priest about the nonsense being fed to her children. And it was at 6 years old I realized that what people said about God and spirituality and religion and heaven and hell already was of dubious veracity. And I had the good fortune to have a mother be home that day and to be able to correct that before it got rooted too deeply in me. Although, unquestionably, It didn't solve the problem. Years later, 8 or 10 years old, I was terrified of going to hell if I missed Sunday Mass until my brother John told me this was really a control issue. This was a control issue to herd the sheep into church to collect money off of them. That's really what it was. And when he convinced me he was telling me the truth, I felt relief. And, you know, that day I spent with him down at the docks in my hometown felt like the first day I ever went to church. That was the first time on a Sunday I experienced God sitting there with my brother talking about hopes and dreams. We were probably 12 and 10 years old or so. It was fantastic. But many of us have had that experience of hearing about this God that's going to punish us and the demands on us, or we would be punished. And when you hear about the story of Abraham and God wanting him to sacrifice his son in order to prove his obedience, you go, wow, this has got to be a really mean God that would be excited about the idea of a man sacrificing a wonderful son to him. To what? To make him feel better? To prove a point? To be obedient? I mean, if God was a God, wouldn't he be able to control anything and everything? Why does he need an obedient of a single man? Didn't make sense to me. But nonetheless, we're told in the Bible that God wanted Abraham to sacrifice his son. And at the last minute, God said, no, you proved your point. It's good. You proved your obedience. I'll spare your son. And when I think of it and recognize that what human beings have done over lifetimes is, wait a minute. If they can normalize the sacrificing of sons, they accomplish two really important points for them, not for the sons, but for themselves, is one of which is they can convince men to use their sons in war. They can sacrifice their sons in the name of patriotism or supporting the king or the duke or God or do the crusades or jihads, you name it. People will sacrifice their sons for this myth and at the same time consolidate their power and control and wealth and influence. The second major important point of this process is it kills off a lot of the competition. The older men who are going to end up being competed with by these younger men, they've cleaned out the ranks of the younger men by sacrificing them at war. So they get killed, and now they're not vying for the power and control because they're out either fighting battles or are killed. It's like, whoa, there are a couple of political reasons why this idea of sacrificing sons is really popular in our culture. It was used by the powerful to keep others weak and to consolidate their own power, as compared to this is a God-oriented, God-pleasing behavior. When I think of, and Jesus refers to this in the Christ letters, the crucifixion as being a sacrifice for the sins of man, it's never made any sense to me as a human being and as a father of children, as well as a son of parents, how any parent could be thrilled at the idea of their son being murdered ruthlessly and horrendously as a necessary step in forgiveness of anything. It's hard for me to imagine the self-talk of God, certainly with a small human mind, to be able to say, wait a minute, I'm still holding a grudge for Adam and Eve's behavior when they disobeyed me. Now, you could look upon that as poor management, put them in the Garden of Eden with a deceitful entity, like a politician, and then when they misbehave, hold a grudge against them for thousands of years, and here we are. The only way I'm going to forgive people's sins is if my son is murdered in one of the most horrendous fashions imaginable. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. And when you look at the way human beings have behaved after that crucifixion, you would go, doesn't seem like it was a very effective strategy, because terrible things have been done in the name of God, in the name of this person who wants to kill people through the Crusades and Inquisitions and mass murders and all kinds of things. It's hard to imagine this being true. And in fact, in the Christ letters, Jesus says, it's not true. It's always been a fiction. It's always been a fiction. It was distorted, and it was the continuation of previous thought processes and superstitions. It's not really true. When you think of the conflict in some of the religious beliefs that we would have been taught, depending on your own personal experience, is this idea of Adam and Eve. For some people, it is evidence, and accepted 100%, it is evidence why human beings are bad. We're doomed because of that first sin, that original sin marks us. We are bad. So, and you need to believe that in certain Christian religions. You have sex. You have to believe that is really true. And then the flip side of it is, and so now be good. If you believe you're one way, your behaviors are going to be in harmony with that belief. And if you buy the first part, that you're bad, defective, you were manufactured badly simply because you were born a human being, and then you try to behave contrary to your beliefs, what you've got going on is a whole lot of stress. I would suggest that is what psychologists refer to as crazy making. You put a person in a position that they can't go forward, can't go back. You hear it as, damned if I do, damned if I don't. You're bad, period. Now be good. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's proof you're bad. Like, that is really, really strange. That is really strange. And if you can imagine that God doesn't like us because of what Adam and Eve did, and we're human beings, so we're bad. If he doesn't like us, how is it we're going to like ourselves? And it's preached from many pulpits how bad we are. And so the chance of us going home after listening to a sermon like that, if we're not self-accepting, it's going to be really difficult to accept the other members of our family or our next-door neighbors. I think this whole idea about unreasonable demands really requires us to evaluate the demands that we're responding to. And if you used half a dozen of the 12 worlds, spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, family, career, financial, just those for instance, and considered what demands, what requirements, what needs, what goals, what do I have to do, what do I need to do, what should I do, what must I not do, what can't I do? And then all of a sudden it becomes clear to you that you have an enormous number of demands and pressures to sometimes go north and go south. Well, that's very difficult to do simultaneously, but a lot of these demands are so diametrically opposed, we're in the midst of a crazy-making situation. Those can be reviewed and revised. I think we have a right to do it, we have a responsibility to do it, and we certainly have a need to do it in order to lessen these demands. If all of these things about what's normal to us, the normal, if making the bed is normal and the unmade bed or furniture needs to be straightened away and certain things in the desk and whatever it happens to be, it doesn't make it good or bad, but becoming aware of it is really the name of the game, so you can choose what you're responding to, and not bother responding to stuff that doesn't serve us. That's the name of the game here. If you were to deal with these demands and see them in a different light, I think we can make a tremendous difference in our spiritual approach to dealing with stress. The other area to work on, in my opinion, is the responses. So Selye would say, it is the non-specific responses to stress is what causes it. And if you can imagine a car and sitting there in park or neutral, but a demand is placed on it, that is a foot on the gas pedal, vroom, 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 that over time is very difficult on the vehicle. The engine of the vehicle is going to be damaged by that behavior. So it is when we're in park or neutral, we don't know how to respond. We don't know whether to go forward or go backward. That's a nonspecific response. We take in the energy that inputted from the foot, that's a demand, and then we're stuck with nothing other than revving our engine. And if that engine is a heart or lung or kidney or pancreas or liver or some other organs of the body, then all of a sudden you can understand, ooh, this could be problematic on a physical level. So these responses to this, these demands, are what we're talking about here. And if we want to go into balance, and balance is the name of the game in a lot of these cases, if we want to go into balance, there are certain things that we're going to do already. These are going to be normal for you. And one of them that I do, and I describe it as journaling. But today I want to describe it in a different way. I want to say, I balance myself by writing. And other people balance themselves by singing. Other people balance themselves by exercising. Other people by reading. Other people by painting. Other people by sculpting. Other people balance themselves by carpentry or some other hobby or gardening or so on. It is these different areas that we use to balance ourselves. What is that about? It's about taking this energy and converting the demands into a specific response. And I just labeled some of these things, and you probably have others that are helpful to you. And if you are not aware of those things that you use to balance you, that is, you direct your energy into, that you choose as specific responses, you're going to want to do that. If you turn around and watch people's specific responses that don't serve them, we describe them as harmful actions oftentimes, smoking, drinking, workaholism, any kind of holism, on and on and on. Those are responses to these demands, but over time, they don't serve us. It's helpful to be aware of that. In the letters, Christ refers to the idea that if we will ask for God's help anytime we do anything, any undertaking, we'll have a totally different experience. We will avail ourselves of a tremendous amount of support, love, abundance will just flood to us. God is ever present, eager to provide the support the way Jesus presents it. And so you can just imagine if you needed help to ask for it. And if you're going to undertake anything, it makes sense to ask for help. Now, I know if you're an American, you think in terms of rugged individualism, I got to do it on my own, I got to pull myself up by the bootstraps. Nobody is doing it on their own. You're not growing your own food, you're not weaving your own clothes, you're not inventing your own television, you're not doing all these things, you're not manufacturing your own car. There's no such thing as rugged individualism. Everything is a cooperative effort. And to know that we can cooperate and be cooperated with this amazing power, this loving, supportive power we call God, that Jesus refers to in a variety of ways to include divine consciousness, that is ever present, eager to support us, we have a whole different experience. And when you turn around and look back and read it, even in the Bible, that where Jesus does miracles, he water into wine and heals sick and loaves and fishes and so on, he's very quick, even in the Bible, to indicate that he's not the source of these miracles, but in fact, it is the Father working through him that is the source of these. And so that says, he knew back then, and he knows now in these letters, that what you want to do is to avail yourself of this God energy to create the conditions that you want, not only in your own life and the lives of your family, but as well as the lives of other people with whom you have contact. Every time you do anything, easy stuff, difficult stuff, creative stuff, mundane stuff, he would say, this is where you would want to connect to your Creator. Avail yourself of this energy and make it so much easier, and you'll see how much support and love you really have going for you. This morning I talked to my brother George. My brother George is a few years younger than me. He was a United States Marine who fought in Vietnam. And he told me this story today that I was unfamiliar with. He said I knew that he had been on a Navy ship, and when they had patrols and ambushes that they went out on, that they were transported to land by helicopter or boat. But I didn't know this part, that one of the guys in his squad, a guy named Art from California, and George, realized at one point when they were talking that they had almost zero control over their lives. What time they went to bed, what time they woke up, when they went into the jungle, what the enemy was doing, whether they were killed or killed somebody else, how long they stayed there. They had no control over any of that. And when they realized they had almost no control over their lives, they made an agreement to give up all control. And what they did is relinquished control to God before every patrol, just on a regular basis. And they did this for their final 4 months in Vietnam. Every time they were going to go into the jungle, they turned total control over to God for their protection and whatever happened or didn't happen to them. George said it was the most physically dangerous time in his life, the most physically difficult time in his life. But in these 4 months, it was the spiritually most wonderful time in his life to realize that he had no control and he turned it over to God. God was responsible for the control. That's not unlike what Jesus says in the Christ letters. And it was absolutely fantastic. George said the challenge is to come back to normal life and have that same reliance, because it's so easy to fall into the trap that most of us experience. I got to do it on my own. I got to do it on my own. If I don't do it, it's not going to get done right. You know, this sort of thing. And I hear this from clients from time to time when they tell me that they are very control-oriented. They want to make things go right. I said, well, okay, tell me what you control. Well, I control everything. I do this and I do that. I said, okay, well, if you're so controlling, grow your hair on your head. Oh, I don't know how to do that. Grow your fingernails. I don't know how to do that. Heal a scratch on your hand. I don't know how to do that. Digest a sandwich. I don't know how to do that. You know what? I don't think you have anywhere near the control that you think you have. I think we control very little. We control very little. Some other force is in control. And the sooner we know it, the sooner we work in harmony with it. And it makes so much more sense to do that. And that point is reiterated throughout the letters by Christ. And it, to me, is so fantastic to know this source is seeking to deliver abundance, health, prosperity, happiness, joy to us. All we have to do is connect, ask for it, allow it, and expect it. It doesn't sound that complicated, but we get into this being disconnected and isolated, and it's all about us, and we got to do it. It's absolutely amazing. I think we have just an unbelievable opportunity when it comes to the spiritual approach to dealing with stress, is to recognize that so many of the demands that have been handed to us are built upon fiction, and we have an opportunity to change which ones we respond to. And every time we decide to respond, if we will invoke God's help, our response is going to be far more effective. So I would say to you, as I say to other people, and I say to myself and my wife and my children, if you've got a stressor, if something is going on that seems overwhelming or more challenging than you can handle, or maybe you can handle it, but it's going to be difficult, the first order of business would be to ask for God's help with that. That's a specific response. Every time you want to do anything and everything, ask for help. That's a specific response. And Hans Selye would say, it is the non-specific response is what is required in order to have stress. And if you can make a specific response every time by turning to God for support, and all of a sudden recognize with a little teeny bit of practice how peaceful you become immediately, then all of a sudden new ideas, creativity, you're thinking better, your body's functioning better, you're more thoughtful, you're smarter, you're just in a better place to implement any of the ideas that are being hand-delivered to you, if you will, by the Creator in response to your sincere, positively expectant prayer. We have a great resource here. This is the way to deal with stress on a spiritual level. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator in connection to all that is, thank you for all of our blessings, not the least of which recently has been the delivery of the Christ letters into my life and through me to other people's lives. But this awareness of the loving God, as that continues to grow, it makes so much sense to us as we come out of fear and we open to this and we want this relationship and we convert the tightrope of our dogmatic fears into a boulevard that we can stroll in enjoyment and recognize that we can tune into the source of all things for our benefit, for the benefit of our families and other people, and we can be the light. We can raise our vibrations to this level. And as Jesus said, there is no higher aspiration than to understand and experience the reality, that is God, that is within and behind all things created. If we can understand and experience God in everything, we're in for just the most magnificent treat and journey and joyride that there could possibly be. That's available. Thank you for making that available to us. And it is so. Amen.